It's the 19th hole with Michael Williams.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another edition of the 19th hole. Michael Williams, your host, bringing you the best of golf and golf lifestyle week after week after week after week. This week we have something from the entertainment. We're going to talk about golf entertainment, both going to see golf as entertainment and both entertaining yourself with golf. How about them apples? First, we have Simon Farnaby, who is the writer of the new movie, Phantom of the Open. It's going to be in theaters. If it's not there somewhere near you now, it's going to be open near you shortly. It is a widely praised movie about a guy who was known as the worst golfer in the world and how he got into the British Open. It is a wonderful movie, actually, and a great golf story, and Simon was deeply involved in it, and he's even in the movie at some point, so he's going to be joining us, and you know, everybody who knows me knows what a huge golf fan and a huge movie fan I am, so this is me, the best of crossing the streams, okay, to get this guest in with us, so I'm so happy about that. Also joining me is my good buddy, John Farrell, who's running the show down at Sea Pines Resort in South Carolina. He's going to talk about travel being back, and they're welcome and waiting with open arms down at Sea Pines. This, of course, the place that hosts the Harbortown event on the PGA Tour every year. One of the most popular events on the entire PGA Tour. Everybody's player, and more importantly, every player and every player's wife wants to attend Harbortown because it's such a cool place to go. It's great golf. I mean, magnificent golf, and also just stunningly fun and beautiful off the course. There's nothing not to like about Sea Pines, but John tells it better than me. So stick around and listen to that. So without further ado, we'll take a break and we'll be back with this wholly entertaining show about golf entertainment. So go get yourself a beverage and a crunchy snack. We'll be right back. Michael Williams, 19th hole. Welcome back to the 19th hole. Michael Williams, your host. I tell everyone, like, I'm a golf guy. Everybody knows that. But if there's anything I'm more than a golf guy, it's a movie guy. I love movies. I can recite entire, not only scenes or quotes. Everybody's got quotes at their disposal, okay? I can actually do a one-man show of Glengarry Glen Ross by myself. And I might do that for one episode of the 19th hole. Just go ahead and go into my best rendition of Alec Baldwin, Kevin Spacey, Jonathan Pryce et al. Okay, this is who I am. Now, I think one of the toughest things to do, they say the toughest thing to do is to hit a one iron, right? Hit a one iron so difficult. That's the hardest thing in golf. The hardest thing in golf is making a good golf movie. And all you have to do to prove that out is look at the golf movies that are out there. There are only a couple that get showed over and over again on golf channels because the rest of them are kind of meh. But there is one that has emerged on the horizon that I think is not only a special golf movie. It's just a special movie altogether. It's called Phantom of the Open, based on a true story about a man who got the golf bug and did more with it than most of us do, and became a worldwide phenomenon. Please welcome to the show the screenwriter of Phantom of the Open, the great Simon Farnaby. Simon, welcome to the 19th hole.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for that introduction. And you're right. It's you know, really good golf movies are few and far between. You know, I love Caddyshack, but it's, in a way, it's not really it's a movie around the sort of game of golf, you know, and the hierarchies and all that. But Tin Cup's okay. You know, it's strange. One of the things I said at the beginning of this, this has got to look good. Like, we've got to get a course that looks like the Open. We've got to have greens that look like greens that pros would play on. and it was really important to me. Then I discovered why golf courses always look terrible in golf movies. It's because no one will let you go and film on on those courses.
Right. Like,
that's why they look so bad, because the members, you imagine it, the local country club or a Muirfield or, a, you know, then the members aren't going to let a crew of 200 people come tramping over the course and shut the course for a day. Like, are you joking? No chance. Not even the amount of money they get offered. So that's why they tend to look a bit shoddy.
And that was one of the questions I was going to be asking, is where you shot this movie, which represented, you're representing some of the most famous courses in the world. But let's let this story start at the beginning.
Okay.
Well, for those who don't know, give us the synopsis of the story of Phantom of the Open. What is the movie about?
Well, Phantom of the Open tells the story of Maurice Flitcroft, who was a crane driver or crane operator, as you say in America, from a little place called Barrow-in-Furness, which is in the northwest of England. Very tiny place, very extremely working class. There's a shipyard there and nothing else. And in 1976, age 46, Maurice gets a colour TV and sees golf for the first time and just falls in love with the game. He always sort of fancied himself as a sportsman and someone who could achieve something. And he thought, well, this is it. Got a set of clubs, sort of ordered it from a catalogue, practiced on the beach for a few weeks. Thought, as you can do with golf, you know, you can play on your own. So you,
yeah.
And he couldn't afford to join a club. So he thought, hey, I seem to be hitting it like they do on the TV. And, you know, I'm pretty good at this. So he entered the British Open. And in those days, you could get in if you sort of just ticked professional, which he did to make things easier. And he got in and it's no spoiler to say he didn't do very well. But he didn't stop there. So he became famous for shooting 121. In the first round and in the qualifying round, and he was then sort of banned by the RNA from entering again, but he didn't stop there. That was just the beginning of the story, and you have to watch the film to see what happens
to get the rest exactly. And let's not gloss over that score. It was 121. Is that what you said he scored in that qualifying round?
He did, yeah. I mean, that was an estimate because his playing partner, who was marking his card, one of the scores has a 12 with a question mark next to it. And when we interviewed him, he said he just disappeared behind a bunker and I saw lots of sand and he emerged about 5 minutes later. And I guessed he'd taken, you know, at least a couple. So I put a question mark next to it.
That is fabulous. Yeah. And Maurice Flitcroft, as portrayed in the film, again, was somebody who somehow golf unleashed a side of him that had been submerged, that person, not only a creativity, but also the relentless nature of him. You represent that in the movie. How did you come across the story? Where did you first encounter Phantom of the Open, and what was the process of it becoming a film?
So I played junior golf. My dad was a greenkeeper, so I grew up around golf. And I sort of, there was mentions of his name in the 80s when I was a junior, and like it was sort of this sort of folk hero figure that all the members sort of hated him and all the juniors loved him because we felt like anything that the senior members hated, we loved, because the senior members were always horrible to us. so Maurice was like one of ours. And then I forgot about him for years. And I sort of played golf. I could have turned pro when I was 16, you know. So I got really good and I played for England juniors. But I sort of knew that I wasn't quite good enough to make it in a way I wanted to, like, you know, play in the Open and the US Masters or whatever. So I got into acting and writing TV and film. And then in 2007, Maurice died. So I read an obituary and I went, oh, it's that guy I remember from being a junior. And And then the more I read about him, which wasn't a lot, you know, but I mean, he was in all the broadsheet newspapers, but very little was known about him. But I just found it a very funny story and a very funny character doing something that no one would dream or dare to do. Doing it badly, but then sort of just persevering, you know, just going, listen, I love the game. I'm going to carry on no matter what anyone says. And I just love that spirit. So did a lot more research. I initially actually wrote a very bad screenplay straight away in a sort of almost in a Maurice Flickcroft fashion.
Was it as bad as his qualifying round? I was going to
Yes, I would go as far as to say, yes, it was. I mean, I just didn't have a clue what I was doing, really. But I was so fascinated by this story and so eager to write it, I wrote a screenplay. Then I learned how to write screenplays, and I co-wrote Paddington 2 and wrote a film called Mindhorn, and learned how my trade, if you like. Then I went back to the story, did lots more research, and actually wrote a book with a journalist called The Phantom of the Open. And then during the research for that book, we managed to get hold of Morris's unpublished autobiography, which was the key to unlocking the whole story. So wow. One of his sons found a box with a few belongings of his in and his handwritten 500 pages.
Wow.
Of all his innermost thoughts and feelings. And it was very, very funny. And that unlocked the whole thing. So I then had lots of ammunition to go at the screenplay properly. And then I sort of knew what I was doing. So really everything you see in the film, so much of it is true. You know, we actually really honed down on it and made sure that everything was true. A lot of the lines he said, what he said, and some of the speeches, you know, speech he makes at the end is verbatim what he said. It's really a sort of tribute to him. He was an amazing character.
Well, that's kind of an amazing find to find that autobiography. I sort of got goosebumps when you were telling me about that, because I mean, you do films that are about real people, and you have, if they're on tape or on film, you can have actual conversations that they had in public. But to find something that actually gives you the character study and what he's thinking, that's just a treasure. Yeah. Now you don't have to go on conjecture. That's amazing.
No, it was hugely important. And it was important to me because one of the things I was worried about was that Morris was just a joker. The whole thing was a joke. Because he was actually a very intelligent guy. Like, he would reread Dickens, and he spoke Spanish and Latin. And so even though he was working class, he was bright. And people would say, what was wrong with him? Was he an idiot? Or was he? And so when I got his book, the first thing I looked for was his intentions, and it was all there. He said he fell in love with the game, adored it, loved the flight of the ball, and thought he was good enough. He went, I genuinely thought I was good enough. But he found out that he realized that he wasn't, really only at the end of the round when he realized how much higher his score was than everybody else. And then he realized he wasn't good enough, you know, or that he had been mistaken. But he was determined to prove everyone wrong.
Yeah.
So he practiced, but of course he wasn't allowed to join a golf club, which really hurt him. That was the big thing that, like, he after the Open, I think he would have gone away after the 1-2-1 if he'd have been able to join a club and just spend the rest of his, you know, retirement. And, you know, he would have done that, but because they banned him from even joining a club, the only chance he had was to play in the Open. So he kept going back. It was a great find. And he loved the game. You know, we talked to Peter Alice, the legendary, you'll know Peter Alice, do you? Legendary.
Of course.
And Peter Alice played with Morris. It played nine holes with him in the 80s for an article from Golf World. And he said that he wished that a lot of pros would have the sort of the view of the game that Morris had, which is that he loved the game, he loved the good shots, the bad shots, his etiquette was immaculate, he was polite, he just adored the game, you know.
Yeah.
He said, of course, he couldn't play. But he went, I wish a lot of pros that you see, modern pros, I wish they'd take the joy that Morris did in the game. So.
And that joy really comes through in the film. We're talking to Simon Farnaby, screenwriter of the wonderful film, The Phantom of the Open, now available in the United States. I got a chance to see it, and it is spectacular. 19th Hole, Michael Williams, your host as always. Simon, let's talk a little bit about the movie and its stars, because once you had your screenplay, you had your book, and now you have a project here. I'm always fascinated by the casting process. And as you were writing and as you completed this, Mark Rylance, the great Mark Rylance, stars as Morris Flitcroft in this. Was he your first choice? Did you picture him and his voice as you were writing, or did that emerge afterwards? When did you get to Mark Rylance in the starring role?
Yeah, so when I was writing the screenplay, I was picturing Morris and hearing Morris's voice, because there is actually footage of him on YouTube and the like. And we got hold of some footage as well from various TV appearances, which actually they're in the movie, you know. If you stay till the very end, you'll see those, and they're really worth seeing.
Yeah.
But we, so that's who I had in my head, but I always thought it was going to be really difficult casting it. And I really hadn't got a clue, because I didn't want an out and out comedian, because then it might turn into Caddyshack, which, although it's brilliant, is not this film. It's not based on a true story, you know. So we needed someone with a bit of weight and a bit of dramatic abilities, you know, who wouldn't just play it for laughs, because Morris wasn't just a goofy guy. He was quite serious. And Craig Roberts, the director, suggested Mark Rylance. And I just went, perfect. That's just, he's perfect. And thankfully, we were in the, we were in a lockdown, actually, at the time. And we were able to shoot, and Mark wasn't doing any theatre, because he really prefers to do theatre than film, or work for Steven Spielberg. Because he doesn't really like filming much. And he loved the story, thankfully. We got it to him. He loved Morris straight away. And then we were off. How that happened.
Right. And for those who don't know who Mark Rylance is, Mark Rylance, 3 Tony Awards, I believe, an Oscar for A Bridge of Spies, an Oscar for that. And I think his my favorite performance of his is in the short film series called Wolf Hall, where he is spectacular. I mean, any story about the Tudors and Henry VIII, everybody knows me, knows I'm in. But he is spectacular in that thing. So I think one of the things that makes it such a special film is having that level of talent present in the movie. I don't know, has there ever been an Oscar winner that's headlined a movie? I guess Bagger Vance, but yikes. That didn't work.
Well, I guess Kevin Costner's got an Oscar, hasn't he? You know, he was in Tin Cup, right?
Yeah,
but he didn't win it for Tin Cup.
No, he won that for Dances with Wolves.
Dances with Wolves, yeah.
So yeah.
Well, listen, I mean, you're right about Wolf Hall. You know, Mark's got a great quality where he doesn't have to say anything, and you can sort of tell what he's thinking. Maybe that's all good actors, but I think Mark in particular seems to be very good at that, and he has a quiet sort of dignity about him.
Yes.
Which is perfect for Morris, because what he's doing is so utterly ludicrous. he's trying to win the British Open despite having never played a round of golf before. And yet he does it with, he maintains a dignity, a sort of majesty beneath all the horrors of what's going on with his golf swing. And, you know, he's, you know, Mark said, he said, oh, you know, I've never been offered a comedy before. And yet he's really funny. He's like a clown in the old-fashioned sense, I think. He's like a clown, like sort of Commedia dell'arte or something. He's got this face that is...
Yeah, I mean, he's funny, but it's in a touching sort of way. And I think that's the other part of the movie that I really appreciated is the way you expose the relationships within the family, because it's not only a story about Morris's love for the game, it's about his love for his family and his love for his city, his love for his area. There's so many connections, so many human connections that are made there. And I think that's what makes golf special to me, is like all these connections. It's the game, sure, and everybody loves shooting a low score, but it's the connection to people, the connection to the area, all these hooks that can be made because of the game. And this movie, with the way you've portrayed Morris Flitcroft, sort of portrays that. It really represents his adoration for not just the game, but everything connected to the game, including his family. Now, I believe it's Sally Hawkins is plays his wife. How did you choose Sally Hawkins?
Well, she, I've worked with her for years, you know, before she became an Oscar-nominated actress. And I was obviously in the Paddington films. She played Mrs. Brown, so I knew her. We're pretty close. And Craig, the director, knew her. He did a film with her called Eternal Beauty, which she was brilliant in, played a schizophrenic in the lead role. And so really it was a no-brainer. We both said Sally, and Sally likes us both. And that was that. It was quite simple, that one, really.
Well,
and she's brilliant.
She is.
Like you say, it's really important that the fact, you know, Morris's family played a big part, and his wife played by Sally was hugely supportive of him.
And
you know,
no, please go ahead.
Yeah, go on.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, but not everyone was. You know, Morris had people in his family who really didn't like what he was doing, and he was an embarrassment to a lot of people in his family, and that's represented by his stepson Mike in the movie. So we just tried to show everything that was happening with Morris, you know, and his twin sons were sort of on the fence and were like, you know, is this philosophy really going to work out for him and for us, you know, of like going for your dreams no matter what.
Yeah.
And so really was an exploration of that. But just to add to what you were saying before about golf and its connections, that's absolutely right. And in fact, Morris said he wanted more people to play golf from his, you know, from working class background. He said golf is for everyone.
Yeah.
Or it should be for everyone, you know. But it sadly wasn't the case for him when they banned him. But he actually thought golf should be like, you know, we have a thing called the FA Cup in England, where
all the tiny my clubs, Reds won this year, Liverpool. So yeah, well familiar.
Yeah, cool. And he said, you know, and teams like, you know, Macclesfield and Darlington and you know, all these tiny non-league teams could play in this cup.
Slough.
And that's what he thought. Yes, exactly. That's what he thought the British Open should be. It should be like open to everyone, so that. Even that the little guys or girls get a chance to maybe, you know, show people what they can do.
It represents that really, really well. And it's kind of interesting now that people are growing the game, more people are coming to golf. We had this big influx of golfers, excuse me, during the pandemic. And now as golf seeks to keep this group of people in, it seems though the patron saint of that is Morris Flitcroft. Why do you do it? Because you love it, because it's great, because it's so much fun. He really is just a perfect representation of that feeling that golf is trying to capture. I got to ask, RNA, were they helpful to you during this movie? Did they cooperate and give you assistance for it, or were they not?
No, they were actually. They've been great. I think they recognize. I spoke to I think Michael Bonalak, who's very forward-thinking secretary. I don't think he's secretary now. He was when we wrote the book, certainly for a long time, sort of maybe even sort of 2010, around then.
Yes.
And he admitted that Keith McKenzie, who was a secretary when Morris was playing, came down a bit too hard on Morris. Like, he said he should have seen it as what it was, just an anomaly. It was just a one-off guy, because, you know, who really actually would want to do that, humiliate himself on the world's biggest stage?
Yeah.
But I think Keith McKenzie at the time was worried that other people might follow Morris's footsteps and try to do the same thing, which of course they didn't. You know, there's never been another Morris Flitcroft. And so Michael Bonalak said, you know, he thought Keith had been a bit hard on Morris, and I think the RNA could see the funny side. And in fact, in the movie, you know, Keith McKenzie, who's represented by Risa Fans, we do sort of, we're not as harsh on the RNA as people might think we would be. You know, we need rules and stuff like that in golf. There's a lot of rules to officiate over. But you got to have a sense of humor as well. And the RNA seemed pretty cool about it. I was expecting a few angry letters or something, but they've been fine so far.
And which brings me to sort of my last question as we close. I saw the movie and I thought it was wonderful. I mean, I really did. Just a great, a love story, husband and wife, love story of the game, relationships between the children and the coworker, so many connections about a man who is just as interested in being a good person as he is in being a good golfer. So I thought it was a wonderful story. And what's been the reaction in the golf world and the cinematic world overall?
Oh, I mean, it's been brilliant all the way. You know, we've had great reviews. I think our Rotten Tomatoes is 93 or 4 or something. But the actually the audience score, if you believe these things, on Rotten Tomatoes was insane. It was like 99%. So it's been really gratifying for me, because my worry was, you know, obviously as golf, it revolves around golf. But this is a film for everyone, you know. Lots of women say they love it, and, you know, non-golfing women and non-golfing men. We had a premiere in New York, which was full of the most diverse, bizarre bunch of people I've ever seen.
Sounds like New York.
I don't know whether that's typical of New York, but and the enthusiasm was incredible. It was, Craig and I said it was one of our best screenings, and because some of the film is set in America, you know, and because Morris, there's several clubs in America actually that have a Morris Flitcroft trophy, and I suddenly thought, we were sitting watching it and I was hearing the reaction, and then the bit where that revolves around America, features America, I suddenly went, oh, we're in America. No wonder they're all loving it. You know, the Americans were the first to sort of get Morris. You know, Morris didn't realize that he was a folk hero in America and in Japan and across the world. And he didn't know, because in his small part of England, he was sort of a bit of a disgrace. So the reaction's been amazing. I'm looking forward to seeing how it does in America. I hope the audiences take to it and it grows there. I think it's starting in sort of the East and West Coast, and then I hope it grows everywhere, you know, because it's for everyone, this story, you know.
I believe that. It is for everyone. And I know movies are released on multiple platforms and venues now. Is it still only available in theaters? Is it streaming? How can people see the movie?
I believe it's the 3rd of June. It's cinemas only in around New York and Los Angeles. I hope I've got that right. And then it's already booked in to sort of spread, you know, as far as it'll go. So, but yeah, it's cinema only for the first chunk, I think. Yeah. But go and see it in the cinema. It's actually shot on film. Craig Roberts shot it on. I mean, I don't know about these things, but he shot it on old style film stock.
Yeah.
If you like. So it looks incredible because he wanted it to look like the 1970s, and it does. So it's worth seeing on a big screen if you can.
It really is. And I think it's just, again, like right at the top of the list of not only golf movies that I've seen recently, of movies overall, it really is a triumph. You're a good golfer. Are you going to be at the Open this year yourself?
I would have thought so. I actually just got an email today about tickets. I went last year. I took my dad down to Royal St. George's. And I've actually been to the US Masters. I took my dad for his 70th birthday.
Nice.
To the US Masters. Unfortunately, it was when Patrick Reed won. no disrespect, but
no disrespect, Patrick.
I think Tiger won. So it was in between Sergio, who's one of my favorite players, and Tiger. So 17 was Sergio, Tiger was 19, and we went in the Patrick Reed one. But that was phenomenal. Have you ever been?
I have been a number of times.
Oh my god!
Yeah, it's
oh
it's
wow.
One
what
of those places
thing that is.
You have to see it to believe it. To see what that place truly is. Yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
If you are at the Open, I'm working on it. So if I get
mine, oh great,
we'll have a pint over there. That would be or we drink.
So you'll be there.
Working on it.
You'll be there in person. Oh,
working
good
on
man.
It. Working on it.
So. Oh, I will. Yeah, you do let me know, and I'll see you there.
Lovely. Simon, thank you so much for taking the time. Really, congratulations on really a special, special film. And can't wait to see what you're doing next. And whenever you feel like talking about golf, just hit me up, man. We'll get you on a microphone, okay?
Thanks, Michael. Been really great talking to you. Nice to meet a fellow golfer and movie buff. And, yeah. And I hope your listeners all feel the same way you do.
Thank you so much. That's Simon Farnaby, the screenwriter of Phantom of the Opera. Again, the story of the amazing Morris Flitcroft. It's just such a great story. It would be a great story anyway, but the way that the story is told, the arc of it, and the way that they portray, again, it's a guy who is in humble circumstances but has great dreams. And I think that describes about 99.9% of the world. And the reason that people don't do things is because they think they're not going to be good at it. I think I just started getting into Game of Thrones, right? And there's a scene where, you know, this sort of pudgy kid who's not really a warrior. He kills one of the most formidable beings in this world. And somebody says, weren't you scared? You know, how did you do that? How could you have done that if you were scared? And he says, I didn't know I was going to kill it. I knew I needed to do it. And that's a message there somewhere, right? That sometimes we freeze because we think we're not going to be perfect at it. We might mess up. We might make mistakes. But one of those things that we have to do is go back to our inner child and say, look, let's do it because it's there to be done. Let's do it because it's fun. Let's do it because we can. And Simon has written a story and created a movie with Mark Rylance and Sally Hawkins that portrays that. Let's do it because we can. That's why we play golf, not because none of us is going to get in the U.S. Open, very few of us, but, you know, we play golf because we can, you know, it's a wonderful thing. So go see a story about that. I think you won't be sorry. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more golf and stuff. Michael Williams, 19th hole. Welcome back to the 19th hole. Michael Williams, your host. I have a really, really strong bias towards some courses and destinations, not only because they provide good golf. It's because they provide good things to do off the course, and they also are just loaded with good people. Fortunately, that's not a short list. There's a long list of places for me that are like that. But at the very top of that list is Sea Pines in South Carolina. Joining me now is somebody who knows even more about Sea Pines than I do. He is the director of sports operations at Sea Pines. Please welcome back to the 19th hole, my good buddy, John Farrell. John, welcome back. How you doing, brother?
Great, Michael. It's a treat to be back with you.
Yes, it is indeed. We were just talking before the segment about how, I mean, for me, you know, there's some of these places where memories are made, you know, and part of having good memories is to play on these courses where you see the pros do their thing. And every once in a while, you know, in our sport, right, it's like you can't get on the field at Lambeau and start throwing passes. And even if you could, you know, good luck. You can't go on Madison Square Garden floor and start pumping up threes. But in our sport, you can go to those temples and hallowed grounds where the pros do their thing and maybe every once in a while do their thing. And that's one of my great memories, is being on the 18th at Harbortown and actually parring that thing. That's all I wanted to do that day. I could have whiffed on every other shot if I had just like made par on that hole. And I hit like driver, 5-iron, 2-putt, done. And it felt like Christmas. I mean, you probably get that a lot, right? People just want to come out and just have a good day on that golf course.
Yeah, and the way it took you 90 seconds to bring up that par you made on the 18th hole. But you're not alone. There's others that have had that good fortune that will never forget it. And that's one of our goals as people arrive, is we'd like them to go home with those kinds of memories. You know, so they'll cherish them forever.
It really does. You know, it's something, just that feeling that you get on a really, I mean, a special golf course. Pete Dye, I believe his best golf course. In my humble opinion, I think it's playable. It's kind of cerebral. It's got sort of that Pete Dye flair, but it's like not too much spice. Like sometimes it's like a little bit over the top for me with Pete Dye, but I think it's one of his. I think it's his best course. But it's just a special place. When you get off the course, again, there's so many other things to do. And then there's so many other golf courses. I'm all over the place here because I love talking about Sea Pines. So we talked about the course that we see for the PGA Tour, but there's a bunch of other golf courses down there too. Really good ones, right?
Yeah. So what we're so flattered by is not so much what we think, but what our guests and members think and what they share with us, and our strength of field for the RBC Heritage every year. We constantly hear from the players and their teams that the players commit, and our field is so strong because a lot of their wives insist that they sign up for this event the minute they get the invitation, because there's so much more to do. It's not like we're going to a metropolitan area where you're fighting the traffic and the waits, and the people go from the 18th green back to a hotel. That couldn't be further from the truth here. You'll see players walking around holding hands on the way to a fishing hole, or going to get a sunset with oysters and shrimp. And there's just so much more to do. I tease people when they arrive, say, take the batteries out of your remote control. There's no TV watching once you drive through those gates, because there's so much to do that you got to do. It's fishing, it's culinary. Our culinary offerings are so comprehensive, and you have something for everyone.
Yeah, they really are. Yeah. Yes.
It's fun. We're trying to I'm the director of fun more than the director of sports.
Director of fun. I like that. That come with a health package too, the director of fun?
Beware.
well, again, the other golf courses, we know about the Pete Dye track famously. You got some other pretty good golf down there too. Talk about that a little bit.
So we've got a point now where for years, Michael, people would call me and say, John, can you get me on Harbortown? Can you get me on Harbortown? Now they call and say, John, can you get me on any of your golf courses in Sea Pines? Because we went to great lengths to, we brought in Davis Love to redo the, what was the ocean, artist formerly known as Ocean Course, is now Atlantic Dunes by Davis Love. And it's just outstanding. The public has spoken and they absolutely love it. It's got ocean view. It's got the green complexes. It couldn't be too much more different than Harbortown. So it's a great complement to it in that the shop values are entirely different. Main complexes are about 6,500 square feet, more than double what Harbortown's are. Some wider corridors, but it's a lot of shop values that are memorable that you'll remember. It's a little more friendly from off the tee. You know, Harbortown's just so tough. You can hit fairways but not have a shot at the hole because of the trees.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we told Davis what our goal was, and boy, did he hear us. And he did a marvelous job with it. And so people, even the tour players that were here that said, early week, that said, can you send us another place to play? We sent them over there, and they came back and said, holy cow, we had no idea. So we have that, and then we have Heron Point, which is also designed by Pete Dye. Smaller greens, tight, very classic Pete, where, you know, you gotta don't short side yourself. And it's a great complement to Atlantic Dunes. So now we have these three golf courses. You can just pick one and go, and then we don't differentiate with regards to our commitment financially to them. So our maintenance budgets are robust, and we're in a position to succeed with green speeds. And we don't want to just be good on our course conditions just during tournament time. We want to have the Joe Q public coming in here deserves the same preparation that the tour player does. And we're committed to that from top to bottom.
Also, I noticed that the and that's another thing you love about the place, that when you go, when it's not tournament week or even close to it, you'll still see the same conditions. I mean, everything's sort of impeccably manicured from day to day. It's predictable and consistently excellent rather than having peaks and valleys. Another thing to appreciate about Sea Pines. We're talking about Sea Pines, if you didn't know, with John Farrell, the Director of Sports Operations. I'm Michael Williams. You're listening to the 19th Hole. We were talking about the off-course options too. The food, the things to do. Let's settle on the food a little bit, because I'm kind of a foodie. You got to like sort of hit the gym while you're down there. Otherwise, you're going to come back a couple of lbs, you know, over what you, the weight that you came through the gates, as you put it. You just got food options all over the place, right? Anything, what's good and what's new and different that you got down there?
Well, what's new and different, most notably, is the new quarterdeck, which is at the foot of the iconic lighthouse. It's a new restaurant offering that we just opened. We opened it the week before Heritage. I mean, the paint was still wet the week before Heritage. And it's been met with great fanfare. The views are unbeatable. It's got fresh seafood. Nothing's been previously frozen. It's got the kitchen. Our director of food and beverage is a French trained chef. They went to great lengths, and our ownership got behind him on this to have the ability to prepare. You know, when you're seating 500 people, food can sometimes feel like it was prepared for 500 people. Well, they went to great lengths to make sure that your plate, when you get it, it's prepared for you. And it's so they have the ability to get these ovens up at 1100 degrees where they can get stuff grilled and charcoal grilled and brought to you fresh and hot for that number of people. It's absolutely outstanding. The energy down there is so cool. It's when you walk in, you know you're at someplace that's just exciting, I think is the best way to put it. And that's at the foot of the lighthouse, so it's in the Harbortown Yacht Basin area.
And so you mentioned that it's a French-trained chef there, and it's interesting that you say that, because more than any other place I've been, maybe in the entire United States. So I've been around, all over in the world, and that European service, there's a particular type of things, especially like that British service. There's a lot of that courtesy, that warmth, that attention to detail. There's something about like a great hotel in London or a great hotel on the coast in Devon or something. And when you guys, your service is just like that. It's like you guys have European trained staff. Do you have somebody like Jeeves the butler who's teaching people how to do things, or how do you? What's going on?
You know, truth be told, that's something we have to work on every single day, and we're, you know, we have staffing challenges just like anybody else does. I don't want to exaggerate it. We have to focus on that. And Matt understands that people have a lot of places they can choose from to spend their discretionary money, so he wants them to walk away saying, "Man, were they glad we're here."
Mm-hmm.
I guess my feeling is there's really no substitute for management by wandering around. You have to be present as a manager. You can't, if you're in your office We don't want to have you preparing for tomorrow's customer at the expense of today's, if that makes sense.
I love it. I'm writing that down.
So we want to be out on the floor, and you want to be watching and seeing and touching and listening to your employees and listening to your card attendants and your caddies and your servers and your greeters and at restaurants. And so that's what we do try and do. And that's what we're, as a matter of fact, our president and our ownership, our president, Steve Birdwell, he, when we have meetings, he focuses on experiential stuff. Everybody as much as he does NOI and ADR and all these fancy financial terms. We're talking about if you take care of delivery, experiential stuff, all those other things, the statistics take care of themselves.
I'm seriously, I just wrote that down and I'm going to be taking credit for it. So if I actually write a management book and that ends up in it, you'll get your payment. Okay. I'll make sure that I scratch you a check for that. I love that. Don't prepare for tomorrow's customer at the expense of today. Beautiful. So we got the food and beverage. We've got the golf. You are the director of sports operations. I know you just mentioned fishing. You've got tennis. You've got some other things. What are the other sporting options that you're offering right now?
So our tennis program, under the direction of our touring professional, just celebrated 50 consecutive years as our director of tennis. And he's not here by a lot of celebrities put their names on steakhouses or car dealerships or things of that nature. Our director of tennis is Stan Smith, who's a former number one in the world. He won both Wimbledon and the U.S. Open. This summer in July, he'll be at Wimbledon, of course, celebrating the 50th anniversary of his win there in 1972. So Stan's on court. So with the exception of the slams where he goes to them, he's on court here training young men and women who aspire to play either collegiate tennis or professional tennis. But we have programs set up for families that don't know which end of the racket to hold and those that aspire to play professionally and everybody in between. And we do the same with our golf instructional programs. So, and then Patrick O'Keefe is our head tennis director of tennis operations with Stan. And so we have Future Stars programs for beginner players, and we have advanced round robins, and we've got a really comprehensive tennis offering, including some pickleball now, which has taken the world by storm.
Yes.
I'm kind of a loyalist to tennis. I'm resisting a little bit, maybe more than I should, but I get it. I get how pickleball, if you've got an hour, you're playing for 59 minutes of it instead of chasing balls into the corner of the court.
that's exactly so
pickleball,
it.
Pickleball, you're playing. You know, if you got an hour, you're playing the whole time. You're not chasing balls around on an Easter egg hunt. So it's been, I get it. But our tennis programs we're really proud of. We got great leadership there. And we're not done. We want to keep getting better at it. And then as far as our fishing, we've got charter boats that are going out daily. And, you know, you see on social media all the people coming in with their happy faces with the kids that have just caught beautiful redfish and other things of that nature. So, again, take those batteries out of that remote control, get out there and take a couple cuts at it, because there's all kinds of things you can do here.
Absolutely. Well, as we wrap up, man, I know that I haven't been down for a while because, you know, people haven't been traveling for obvious reasons, but I do plan to come and take a visit soon. So, the challenges that all destination folks have faced, you have faced too. Do you feel like you're back exactly where you were right before the pandemic hit in terms of your product and your ability to deliver that thing to the public at the level that not only they expect, the level that you expect?
Well, what's happened with golf is not unique to us. It's happened all over the world, the UK and private clubs around the country. The demand is exceeding the supply with golf right now. And before the pandemic, that was not the case.
Yeah.
We were being more creative, and everybody was being forced to look at their rates presentation. They were looking at how they attract members. There's all these clubs now have wait lists, and we're no exception to that. People who were a place where a great number of our people had second homes. So if you're from Flint, no offense to Flint, or to Cleveland or anything like that, and you have a second home in Hilton Head and Sea Pines, where are you going to spend that time when you're not going back to the office? So our occupancy levels are really high in our homes and villas. So the demand on our golf courses is higher, and more people are playing golf, and those people who are playing more recreationally or playing more casually are now playing more often. Mm-hmm. And that's not just here. That's all over the place. And it's been a wonderful phenomenon. It's one of the, unfortunately, you hate to have something be at somebody else's expense because COVID was awful and still is. But it's pretty cool to see the number of people that are out enjoying golf and tennis and boating and everything. Biking. Can't find bikes. There's supply chain problems with everything.
Right. Yeah, I mean it's a situation that, as you say, has affected everyone in so many different ways. But it's just good to see places like yours just be available now, and people starting to come back and get a chance to be together with their families and be together in a special place. And as I said at the top of the show, it's a place to make some memories. You know, you definitely have that going for you. So when people want to go and book a trip to make some memories, what's the best way to get that done?
I mean, go to our website, www.seapines.com, and that's where you can get started, and then call one of our vacation specialists and they can help you untangle whatever it is that you need to do, whether it's lodging or advanced bookings for restaurants and golf and tennis and boat, everything. They can do it all.
Perfect. I'm going to get on there and do that myself, because I am old enough to remember watching Stan Smith win his Wimbledon championship. So I imagine I won't be the first one to do this, but if I get myself a Stan Smith, a big old pair of size 13s, he's going to sign them for me, right?
Well, yeah, he is so good at that. He's not just a great gentleman for tennis. He's one of the nicest men I've ever known in anything. And he's, and his wife is, Margie, is just as lovely, and their family, they're really, we're so fortunate to have them as our friends and members of our professional teams here, because they're just that nice. And he would find out about you. If you walked over with a pair of shoes and asked him to sign them, he'd be asking you questions about you, and he'd wait for the answer. He really wants to know.
We got to make that happen, okay? Let's get with the team and make that happen, because again, on my Stan Smith, he can sign his middle name too, okay? There's plenty of name room on my
Stan
Smith.
Still a number one selling shoe with Adidas Sportswear is the Stan Smith shoe. It's been relaunched a few times. It's just wonderful how much people love it.
Yeah, he's iconic. He's iconic, as is C. Pines, and as are you, my friend. Thanks so much for taking the time. I know you're busy. I'll just get back to it, making a great experience, and look forward to having you back in, John.
Great. Thanks, Michael.
You got it. That's John Farrell, Director of Sports Operations at C. Pines. Again, the place is, as he alluded to, you know, you can look to, you know, you can go to, you know, all the advisor or people who are giving stars, you know, to things and that sort of thing, or checks, or however they rate things. But if you want to know what places are really special, look at the tour event, the places that the tour players absolutely want to go because their wives say, you're playing this event because I want to go. And this is one of those places where the PGA Tour wives, actually, that would be a great thing to have them do a rating service for the different courses and destinations, because all players want to go to this place and spend time there because of the golf. And, you know, they play great golf everywhere, and it's the experience that you get off the course, the accommodations, the food, and it's the people. Again, that South Carolina hospitality, that's number one with a bullet when it comes to how to treat people. So why don't you go online and get yourself some, okay? We're going to take a quick break. Come right back with more golf and stuff. Michael Williams, 19th hole. That's it, and that's all for this edition of the 19th Hole. I want to thank my very special guest, Simon Farnaby. How cool is it to have an actual movie guy in to talk about his movie, The Phantom of the Open? Again, it's a great movie. I loved it. Mark Rylance, I'm a big fan. It's just, you know, it's a not only just, as I said, it's not just a great golf movie. It's a great movie overall that happens to be about golf. So I think if you see it, you won't be sorry. Go check this out, okay? And also, Sea Pines. I mean, look, you love golf, go south, love that southern hospitality. Let's see, if you like food, if you like golf, if you like really nice hotel rooms, if you like really good cocktails, you know, gourmet meals, all those sorts of things. If you like those sorts of things, maybe you want to check out Sea Pines. That's all I'm saying. Hey, look, if you want to talk to me about the content that's on the show, I'm easy to find. You can hit me up on social media. On Instagram, I'm on Michael Williams TV, and on Twitter, it's Michael on TV. Yeah, that's what it is. Hit me up there. Send me a message anytime. Operators are standing by. Look, thanks so much for listening. We do it all for you. We'll be back next week with another great show. In the meantime, go out, hit some balls. Do attempt to hit them straight. But more importantly, don't count the days. Make the days count. Michael Williams, 19th hole.